Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters Radio.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Matthews, and we're here again at Growth Matters Radio, where we just spend time with executives and business professionals in our community to understand their insights and thoughts and lessons learned from running organizations and helping them to grow. And I'm real excited this morning. We have two guests. We have Mark Wilson, who is the president of E-Verifile. And E-Verifile is an organization that is really focused around creating safer and more secure workplaces by providing people intelligence to their customers. Sort of one of the things I know about their organization is they do a lot of background screening, and they're really moving into the area of screening contractors for their various clients. And we also have with us Kim Anderson, who is the executive director of Families First. And Families First is a very well-known nonprofit here in the Atlanta area that is really focused on how to ensure the success of children so that they can empower families to reach their greatest potential. And each of them will share a little bit more. But welcome to the show, Mark and Kim. How are you this morning?
Doing great. Thank you, Michelle. Happy to be here.
Great. So why don't we start out with Mark, you just kind of giving us a thumbnail sketch about how E-Verifile serves its clients and maybe even share a little bit of news that you got last week that's exciting.
Sure. Well, E-Verifile basically is in the business of providing people intelligence, as Michelle mentioned, and primarily through background screens. We focus on trying to adhere to what our customer standards are around, you know, the information that they need to properly, you know, check a person out, whether that be for employment purposes or whether it be if it's a contractor that they're trying to make sure, you know, meets their standards. And the exciting news that Michelle mentioned is that our company was selected to be a part of the Inc. 5000 last week.
So. Great. And if I'm not incorrect, that Inc. 5000 is really related to 3 years overall growth in revenue. So that's quite exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, Kim, share a little bit of a thumbnail set about Families First.
Sure. Thank you, Michelle. Families First is Georgia's largest and leading family services agency. We've been around 123 years with the goal of empowering families to make sure that not only that families are self-sufficient and rise out of poverty, but that children who otherwise have been disenfranchised or vulnerable have opportunity to be successful. So we serve about 40,000 people around metropolitan Atlanta and somewhat throughout the state of Georgia through 200 employees at 16 locations.
Great. So one thing I know about both of you is that, you know, prior to the role that you serve in your organizations today, you have had other careers, other things. So tell us both a little bit about, you know, sort of how you've prepared for the role that you serve today. And Kim, I know you are an attorney by practice, by trade originally. And tell us a little bit about your history.
Sure. So I practiced law for about 15 years, primarily beginning as a litigator, then as a healthcare lawyer. Most importantly, worked as the first general counsel at Grady Hospital, which is our large public hospital here in Atlanta, and then also did private sector healthcare. And at the end of the day, began to explore why I did what I did and realized that I enjoyed changing lives and making a difference, but wanted to do it in a more personal way. And began looking at perhaps doing what I did after 5 o'clock to see if I could do it before 5 o'clock, and which led to a transition into nonprofit and then eventually nonprofit management. Got to Families First primarily through really soul searching about what I thought would make a difference in the world in terms of alleviating poverty and believing in my heart that at the end of the day it begins with the family. So it's probably a lot of experience on the ground as much as it is reading. It's just listening to people and surrounding myself by great people who had great dreams and imparted those dreams to me.
Yeah. So, Mark, I know a lot of our listeners, they think about running organizations and being an entrepreneur. What sort of prepared you to be able to serve in this role?
Yeah, it's interesting, the comments are just made about, you know, purpose is basically what I heard there. And that was the catalyst for me starting the first business that I had. And I was able to do that out of working. I worked for Dun & Bradstreet for 15 or so years professionally and learned all that I could about what it meant to actually run a business, but never really had any entrepreneurial aspirations until I had one assignment that sort of turned things for me where it was sort of a turnaround situation in one of our offices, and I got exposed to how it is that I felt that I could make a difference in the lives of people, even at work. And so as the opportunity presented itself for me to start my own business, then I took full advantage of it because I could see that, you know, for what I was doing corporately, I could do as an entrepreneur and sort of keep that going. And I just think I was fortunate working for D&B that the nature of their business is, you know, gathering information about companies. And so it afforded me some real information about what it takes to day-to-day run a company. And that's benefited me greatly as E-Verifile, my current company, is the second venture that I've been a part of. And obviously the first venture, there were a lot of learnings that prepared me for what we're doing today.
Yeah, so in terms of what's happening today at E-Verifile and some of the things that you've been able to do that have helped you grow and succeed, talk a little bit about what's on the radar for you in terms of where you're trying to go and what you're trying to do.
Well, you know, again, we had the first venture, which was the name of that company was Ryla. It was an outsourced call center practice that we had. And, you know, that took all of the experience that we had there. It was a good run. We were able to grow that business and then sell it in 2010. And so what it did was set the stage for what we're doing now in terms of what growth means and how to manage growth in an organization. So we bought a business as E-Verify was bought. It was a family-owned company. And so relatively small, small in its focus as far as the customer base. And what we're looking to do now is to leverage all of the experience that we got in the last adventure. And I say we because there are a number of people that were on my team at Ryla that are with me at E-Verifile. So we're taking some of the things that we learned over there and trying to put them in place here to hopefully have E-Verifile have the same level of growth and success that we had at Ryla.
So if I were to ask you sort of in the next 2 to 3 years, what is really the focus of your growth?
We're leveraging a lot of what foundationally had been put in place by the previous owners, and we just want to take that to the next level and try to expand our customer base, expand our brand and our reach throughout, you know, really the world. Definitely there's a need for us to do better domestically, too, in the Fortune 500, you know, list of companies out there in terms of expanding our reach to them. And so we want to expand on the services that we have or that have been put in place prior and to try to get them in front of some of these bigger companies that heretofore hadn't been the case.
Great. So, Kim, I know that one of the things that you have in your organization and your board is working on is really helping Atlanta think about transformation and how to maybe see this whole issue of children in poverty and families in a different way. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, your strategic plans for where you're trying to take Families First and the community.
Sure. So I guess for us, at the end of the day, we're trying to make sure that everyone understands that children living in poverty impact people you know and people you don't know, and that it impacts our business, it impacts our quality of life, even if I don't know anybody personally living in poverty. And so at the end of the day, our goal is to raise up the status, the impact of poverty's having on children, having on us as a community, and helping business, individuals, government better recognize how they can make a difference in that and how it will better their lives. Unfortunately, sometimes when we don't think things impact us, we don't get engaged. So we sort of have to break it down in a way that people understand that poverty impacts us all, even those of us who are fortunate financially. So our goal is to both engage the business community, to engage the civic community, engage individuals, even those living in poverty, to really understand how they can eradicate poverty very simply by simple things that they can do in their lives, in their personal lives, in their business lives. Something as simple as conversations we're having with members of the business community saying, are you thinking when you hire, who you hire, and how you might change not just their lives, but the lives of their children and their families, and that you're making, in essence, an investment in yourself and in your community. So those kind of conversations we think are important. And part of our strategy is then to partner with business, to partner with government in a very different way, and partner with our clients in a way that they own their own and are accountable for their own success.
Yeah, you mentioned the term partnership, and I know for both whether you're a for-profit or you're a nonprofit, today people are really seeing how do we not reinvent the wheel, how do we make the best use of what our core competencies are, but leverage partnerships and alliances to help achieve whatever our objective is. So in that way, whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit, you know, growth means that you've got to have good strategic relationships. Mark, how has that played into growth at E-Verifile and how you see the future?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's difficult, particularly if you have aspirations of growth being significant, to do that alone as a small business. And so we've embraced it even so much to the point that competition is not a barrier or a wall that scares us. And you know, so said differently, I look at our competitors as potential partners. In fact, our model at E-Verifile right now has partnership with our competitors at the very center of it. So, you know, and to not get into so much detail about, you know, how our business works, but essentially, we provide data, and the aggregation or collection of that data is, you know, it takes infrastructure investment and actually time to build up, you know, a process where you can get that on a large scale. And so most of our competitors have done that and have invested in infrastructure that allows them to do that over time. And there's no way for us to catch up to them as a small business. And in fact, in my opinion, it doesn't make very much sense to even, you know, think about it. So what we've done is partnered with them, and we've created revenue streams for them where we buy the data that they go out and collect and that we as companies, them and us, sell. And so they see us as a new revenue stream for their business, as another way to sell the data that they go and have the infrastructure to collect. And it's just a great example of how, you know, if you are an entrepreneur or a small business and you're trying to figure out ways how you can grow your business, you know, quite often we don't go to the level of thinking of our competitors as a place to, you know, to form those partnerships. But in our case, and I'm sure there's others out there, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, so, you know, it's at the center of what we're trying to do. I just realized, and it's one of the lessons from the first company, is that, you know, strategic partnerships are essential.
Kim, how is it playing out in the work you're trying to do?
It was fascinating because I was listening, and the language, unfortunately, people think nonprofits should operate differently than for-profits, but the language and the actions are the same. At the end of the day, for us, it's thinking about other nonprofits that do what we want to do better than we do, or bring assets to the table that we need to fulfill our goals, and asking and seeking partnerships. But also looking at in the for-profit sector and thinking from the other side of the table, what does that particular business look for in a client, and versus what my clients need, and how can we partner? Or if I'm a property owner, in order for my property to enhance in value, really, what do I want for my residents? And then in turn, what I as a nonprofit can bring in selling and helping the nonprofit, the for-profit, see the value of our partnership together. And also leveraging our assets, understanding what we do well, and realizing that may it be government, for-profit, or another nonprofit, that I have something that value and that can help them accelerate their goals, may it be a healthcare provider who may want and seek better results for their clients that I can help happen, and setting that forth in a way that is exciting to them, puts forth their goals, but also propels my goals as well. Yeah. So sort of it's very similar, very similar.
And I love last week we also had an executive from a nonprofit and then also from for-profit, and I think your point is well taken, Kim, that a lot of times we just think that that is such a different foreign world, and there are things that are very different, but there's a lot of commonality, and not only can nonprofits learn from businesses, which I think pretty much most savvy nonprofit professionals understand there's things they can take away, but also on the flip side, there's things from the nonprofit world that businesses can take away to help them increase their value and think about how they're engaged in the community. So one thing that I know, regardless of what kind of organization you're running, cash is king. And that whole idea of how do you have the capital to be able to do the things that you want to do is always pressing on an executive's mind. You might have to go about it in different ways based on non-sector and for-profit, but still cash is king. So, Mark, given that you've had a couple of organizations that you've started up, I know this is probably near and dear to your heart, you know, what suggestions would you give to our listening audience around how they acquire the capital, be able to grow?
Yeah, Michelle, I'm really glad that you asked the question, because I think, you know, for those entrepreneurs and small businesses that I come in contact with, you know, on a day-to-day basis, that are struggling with this issue, you know, I find that it is a question of education about what the process is, or actually where there are sources of capital that the folks can take advantage of. And it's something that I really want to be a part of, trying to make sure that the messaging gets out about how it is that businesses, both not-for-profit and for-profit. I know not-for-profit, it's a situation where there's a lot of fundraising. But, you know, just having access to the capital is very important, as you said. But for us, it was fortunate for me in the first example of our company where I used a small business consulting company to put together a business plan for me. And they actually had contacts in the private equity world. And so they put our plan out. And so I was able to get some attention and attraction through them. And we ultimately raised about $1 million in the first venture, and that was enough to kind of get us started. And, you know, and it led to us raising a second round a few years later for about $7 million, which was really the catalyst for a lot of growth and the success that we had, and we sold the company. And now that that's behind us, it's much easier to have the conversation with those that have the money. So to answer your question, Michelle, the advice that I would give in retrospect would be studious. You know, you have to understand, you know, what it is that's out there as far as money is concerned, and then what it is that you have to do to be prepared to get it. And so there's no shortcuts. You can't go and buy the book Business Plan for Dummies and think that you can put your business plan together yourself, and that's going to be attractive and interesting enough for someone to invest money into your business. It's not likely. And so, you know, I would say you need to hire and try to find the right professionals that can help with that. And most of the time, those professionals do have access and understand where it is that the sources of capital are. And it's warm. It's a warm introduction generally when it comes that way. And then at that point, it's about you selling your business and selling what it is that you think that you're going to be able to do to get them a return on the investment that they may make in your business. So
Kim, what's your perspective on things that you have learned through the fundraising process? Because to Mark's point, it's more about fundraising and making sure that you have people that are supporting you and the goals that you're trying to accomplish.
You know, I think that over time we've learned that fundraising, in the sense that many people think it, and that it think is that I'm asking you to give me a charitable contribution, is sufficient. And I really think that people, particularly donors, and are truly investors. And so you have to approach it from an investment standpoint and say, may they be government, may they be corporate, may they be an individual, may be at another business or another nonprofit, you're asking them to invest in your goal, invest in your mission, and they want to know what they're getting out of it. And so just as if I was to go to any, if I was a for-profit and I was trying to get someone to invest in my business, I want them to understand the return on their investment. I want them to connect to my mission, to connect to their mission. So I have to do the same as a nonprofit. I have to help you understand why what I do is important to you, maybe personally from a business perspective or both. I have to then tell you what I promise to do and how it's going to benefit not just your heart, but your personal mission and maybe even your financial investment. Once you make that investment, I have to come back and tell you how I did. And did I fulfill my covenant to you, but also those that I've agreed to serve? And I really think I have found that investment approach, may it be to a donor, to a corporation, even to a philanthropist, is really important. And to understand they have, particularly now, people have choice. They can get online in a minute and find a nonprofit in Bangladesh or in Botswana or in Austin, Texas, and choose to make a donation, see what's going on, and feel good about it. And so I have to help them understand why investing in Families First is critical, why it will make a difference in the lives of not just those people that I serve, but in their lives.
That's very very interesting perspective, because as a person that, you know, on a couple of nonprofit boards and frequently approach for, you know, support for different nonprofits, I don't know that the approach has necessarily been that. And I was just sitting here thinking that if it had been, then my mindset about it would be completely different. It's very interesting.
Yeah. One of the things that you were saying in your as you were sharing about that sort of investment philosophy is this idea of the promise. You know, what is the promise that you're making for that investment? And so if I were to sort of turn that back around to you, Kim, and Mark, and say, for you, Kim, what is the promise of that investment so that people can better understand what Families First is really doing and why they want to get behind it?
Sure. So it's interesting because we were just talking about this morning, because we've started screening applicants and we'll be doing clients based on that question. That we've made a covenant. We made a covenant to community that we are going to help families be more self-sufficient, that we're going to break cycles of poverty, and we're going to help children be more successful and deal with issues of abuse, neglect, and hopelessness. And so every day we have to understand that that's what we've promised. And are we doing it? And why? What are we doing? And why are we doing it? And is it helping move that ball? And particularly in Atlanta, where 4% of children who live in poverty will come out of poverty. I mean, we've taken on a big task, and we have to understand that every day, own it every day, and be creative and generative and thoughtful every day of how we're doing that, and are we meeting our promise? I don't think that we can take that more lightly in a nonprofit than UPS does in terms of delivering a package on time, or you do in terms of promising that the background check and the information I've given you is correct and accurate. And because our business and our reputation depends on those results, just like the results of any for-profit.
For us, for me, it's threefold, Michelle, in that I have three constituencies that I have to keep in at top of mind about the promise that we have and how we're going to deliver on it, and that be our customers first, you know, what it is that we're doing as a service, you know, making sure that, you know, what we say we're going to do, that we're absolutely delivering on that. And then we have our investors, those that have invested in the business, the promise that we have to them that we'll do what we said we would do when we raised the money from them, and to put them in position to get a return. And then the third would be the folks that actually work in our company, because for us, you know, nothing gets done without the people that work for us. And so we make a commitment to the, everybody that works on our team that we're going to do certain things that promote their development and their success and their happiness as far as work is concerned. And so we have to work every day to make sure that we're delivering on that as well. So it's, you know, it's three different constituencies, I would say, that we have to, you know, make sure we keep in focus about doing what we need to do day to day.
Which, as again, as you were talking, it makes it an easy segue for something that I think our listeners always are interested in, and that is how you as leaders create the type of culture and the environment that you need to be able to attract the people to work with you or volunteer with you, and then to be able to deliver on that service. So when you think about that sort of cultural aspect, what for you has been the approach or that you've used to ensure that you're creating a culture that's going to be supportive of your growth objectives?
Yeah, it's just it's to me the biggest I don't understand why there are executives out there that haven't figured out that people and the focus on people is the key to any level of success that you're going to have or that you can have as a business. It's just my opinion. I think in our first company it was fairly easy because it was an industry that was that had a stereotype of how it operated around people that wasn't very good. It's, you know, low wage, dead end sort of jobs, no future, you know, no real focus on the person that was actually delivering day to day. And so it was easy for us to go in with something that was different than that. And then that, for me, was a good business imperative because I knew that those that were potential customers that were actually buying our service understood the stereotype that was already out there, and that if we operated separate from that, that they would identify it readily right at the beginning, and that they could make the connection between how we were doing things and better customer service for their clients. And so it just made good business sense for me to, you know, to do that. So, you know, our focus was always about the people. In the call center example, it was creating the best job that you've ever had. So our mantra was, you know, if you work for us, our goal is to have you feel like you've not ever had a better job. And we've carried that through in the current company at E-Verifile. And it's the same approach where we just take care of the people that work for us, understanding that, having them understand that if we got it right with them, that it's going to be good with our customers. And, you know, it's just important. And that's how we approach business.
Kim?
No, I was listening and I was thinking for us, the first thing is I work from a perspective that people are who they are 24 hours a day. And so we have to connect with who they are deep in their soul, right? Why are they here on earth and what are they trying to accomplish? And because we're asking them to devote more hours of work awake doing what our work than they're going to do anything else on most weeks. So we have to make sure that our organizational mission and their personal mission are aligned. And that has to be from the gate. And then the second thing is a commitment to them that if this is in line with your calling, your individual and personal calling, then second to, of course, delivering results for our clients and our investors, the next thing is we're committed to you. We're committed to helping you figure out and move to the next level, whatever that is on this journey we call life. And I think once we do that and once we realize that that's aligned, then they are naturally going to help propel our mission because it's their mission. And if I'm helping them grow, then the organization's going to grow. If I'm helping them be generative, then the organization is going to be generative. So that's the posture which I work in and try to do that as much on a group level but on a personal level with all my colleagues.
Yeah, and if I could just add on to that, you mentioned earlier about realizing the work that you do and the impact that it has, the larger impact that it has on the community. And it's something that we've tried to keep in focus, and that's the domino effect, that if we're having a positive impact on that person that's working for us, then what does that translate and mean to the larger community, to their families, to how it is that they contribute, you know, to society? And I think it's made it easier for us to be serious about this, you know, having people feel good about where they work and taking real responsibility to develop and grow folks that work for us. I think our leadership, once we've made that connection with them, that there is a domino effect outside of work, it's made it easier for them to commit and to be serious about it. And so we try to do things that highlight the impact that our company is having on that person and their extension into the community with their family and all. I just think it's been important. I've tried to stay, you know, focused on it and true to it as a leader.
Yeah, so in order to keep growing your organizations, the point that you're making is your people have to grow. I would like to turn a little bit and personalize that a little bit, because as an entrepreneur myself, I always tell people, boy, do you learn a lot about yourself once you decide that you're going to provide leadership to an organization. And I was reading in a magazine this week, and I saw two different things, and I'd like to sort of see where your perspective is. So one is from Dante's Inferno. Limbo is the first circle of hell. I thought, boy, that's true. That's all that whole uncertainty thing. What happens in terms of wanting to lead and to grow, but a lot of it is very uncertain. And so to be a really strong leader, you have to get comfortable with sometimes being uncomfortable and take the step anyway, which does sort of put you sometimes in that limbo, and it can feel exhilarating, and then it can feel daunting. So, Mark, what's something that you have had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable with so that you could be a better leader?
It's a really good question, and there's probably a few things that I could cite, Michelle, but probably the question of faith and how it is that it plays out in the work environment. And so, you know, I think we're afforded some opportunities as business owners to do things. You know, you have more latitude than maybe if you're in a corporate setting, you know, where it is that you're wanting to be a strong leader for where you operate. And for me, that's faith-based. And I didn't want to separate my leadership from that. So, you know, trying to figure out how it is that I could be inclusive and respectful of everybody's points of view about where they were or where they are with faith, and how that plays a part in their day-to-day life, and how it would play a part in what they do for us at work, how I could be respectful of that, but still not separate myself as a leader from what I think is core to my leadership style. And so, you know, just trying to figure that out has been a challenge, and, you know, but not really that hard. I mean, if you follow simple principles around respect and honoring everybody's different points of view, even staying true to what you believe, it works out, and we've not run into any trouble. But I mean, navigating through those waters has been, you know, a little challenging.
Hmm. Kim, what has been your thing that you've had to get comfortable with, even though you're uncomfortable?
It's almost an oxymoron, because it's getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? It's taking, in our case, a mission and saying, understanding that a different leader may have decided to fulfill the mission in a very different way, and getting comfortable with my way may not be the only way. It may not even be the right way, but at least getting comfortable that I've thought it out, asked enough questions, asked enough people enough questions, engaged enough people that I'm comfortable with that there's going to be parts of it I don't know what's going to happen, but at least that I feel I've done the best I could do to say, well, if we try this, at least I know that we've worked out as much as we could and be comfortable moving into the uncertainty part. So I think it's almost like any due diligence, right? It's only as much as you know to do. There's always going to be parts that you didn't know to do, but you got to get comfortable with the fact that you did the best you could. So for us, in sort of re-engineering a nonprofit or any organization, any business, particularly post this recession / depression, and trying to figure out what the new normal is, getting comfortable with the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty, but have I thought through them as much as I could? Have I asked enough questions? Have I invited as many smart people as I can to the table with me to ask me hard questions? I think that's the best way I can work through that uncertainty and move out of limbo, right? Because that can be so paralyzing. It gives you a certain degree of comfort at the time, but at the end of the day, you're paralyzed. You're really paralyzed.
Yeah. So maybe as a way to begin transitioning and winding down our conversation, would either of you say that there has been a particular initiative or something that you tried to accomplish with your organization that didn't quite go the way you wanted it to go, but you learned such a valuable lesson that you were able to play that lesson forward and you're seeing the fruits of it as you're, you know, working through your current challenges?
You know, I was thinking we have worked really hard to be data-informed, and that is to say, to really push our staff to be clear about what they want to achieve with the services and measure that and sort of do this double-loop learning. And some have done that very well. But I think in some respects, and in one or two situations, I might have taken that a little bit of light and thought I saw more light and pushed a little bit harder than the team was ready to go. And so when you do that, so what I've learned from that is to maybe look a little deeper and understand whether what I saw was a flicker of light or was it really bright lights, you know, or was it in my mind or was it, you know, a reality, and to engage people more in a deeper question. Because sometimes when you're the visionary of an organization, you want everybody to see it right away, right? And you want everybody to be on board right away. And having patience that what you might have spent a lot of time thinking about may be your business plan, or other people may not get it as quickly as you did, and you have to acknowledge how long you've been really spending thinking about it and be patient for other people to their growth and acknowledgement and not rush that, because it does take time. It does take time.
So two things. First, again, piggybacking on what Kim has said about patience, it's not necessarily one of my strong suits. I don't know that I would categorize it as a strength of mine, but definitely something that is important, because in most situations as a leader, you are thinking about the bigger picture and things, and nothing can get done fast enough. You know, it's especially if you got the next best idea, you want to have that best idea get out there like now. And the reality of it is, in a lot of situations, it's just not possible. And having a healthy patience about that, I think, is important. But the second thing is, I think being less idealistic about things, particularly around the people question and how it is that you go about trying to motivate and incentivize people, do things to support the people that are in your organization. For me, you know, taking a very idealistic approach to that and thinking that the things that I thought were going to be good and wildly accepted were not necessarily the things that people really wanted. And so, you know, I think we lost a lot of time on things like that, and money even, invested in some of these ideas that weren't really that effective toward what people's interests really were. And so I think, you know, in retrospect, I'd be a little less idealistic and maybe take a more practical approach to try to understand what was going to be more motivational for our people.
Yeah. So I really appreciate the insights that you've shared with us today, and I think just a number of things are very valuable, hopefully for our listening audience. Kim, if you were to look back on yourself, you know, right out of college as you were starting your career and you wanted to give yourself today some advice, what would you tell your younger self?
I probably would definitely have taken time between undergrad and law school and really spent more time seeing the world. I think oftentimes we think we know what we want to do and we go after it, but if we have more conversations with people, we realize that there's more to create than to jump into what there is, right? So understanding that in each one of us there's, particularly now, you can create so much of what you want to do versus doing what others think you should do, or even accepting a job, but creating a job, I think is something we don't have enough conversation with young professionals about.
Yeah, I love that. Accepting a job, you can create a job versus accepting a job. That's a different way to look at the market. Mark, what would you tell your younger self?
Well, I think I would try to convince my younger self that that to have an understanding of what I now understand, and that is everything is possible with the proper amount of work and attention to the things that you may want to accomplish, and that, you know, most of the great things that have been created in the world are, you know, from fairly simple-minded, practical thinking people that didn't or don't necessarily have anything on me as a 20-year-old. So I would just, and I think it's actually even more important for folks that have the background that are similar to what mine was, which was very humble and, you know, not with a lot, that everything is possible, and that if I work hard enough that I can do just about anything.
Yeah. So with everything being possible, let's tell our listening audience how they can find out more about eVerifile and the things that you're doing. How do they contact you and or learn more about your organization?
The easiest and simple way is to our website is www.eVerifile.com, and everything about our company is there, including how to reach us. And so I would encourage everybody to do that.
Great. And Kim, how can we learn more about Families First?
I go to our website, familiesfirst.org. Also, we have a YouTube channel, so if you just do Families First on YouTube, there's some wonderful videos of many people who've benefited from our work and our employees talking about their work. So great. I would encourage you to do both.
Well, great. Well, that's another show that we've had of Growth Matters. Hopefully you took some nuggets away that will help you as you continue to grow in your career and you continue to grow your organization. So meet us back here Fridays at 10, and let's talk about growth because
growth matters.
Thanks, everyone.